Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Nurses, doctors, and healthcare workers across the country are taking to social media to express their continued frustration and fear over running out of personal protective equipment. Many say they are reusing masks or resorting to making their own. Yesterday, nurses took to the streets in front of several California Kaiser hospitals saying, "When nurses aren't safe, patients aren't safe." On March 21st, the American Medical Association, the American Hospital Association, and the American Nurses Association called on the Trump administration to immediately use the Defense Production Act to increase the domestic production of medical supplies and equipment that all frontline providers so desperately need. And we're just getting some breaking news from the New York Times that the Trump administration is, in fact, going to use the Wartime Production Act today for the very first time to mandate the production of 60,000 coronavirus test kits as state leaders ramp up pleas for assistance. And we'll keep doing some research. Oh, yes, here it is. This is just coming down right now. So just excuse me, I'm reading this in real time. We're also getting news that they're going to insert language from the law into a mask contract for 500 million masks. Nurses and frontline workers have been calling for this for over 2 weeks. And so now we are finally seeing action. And joining us to talk about what it has been like on the front lines is Jennifer Caraher, a public health and advanced practice triage nurse at a large Bay Area hospital. Jennifer is also a medical sociologist. She says her hospital has run out of eye protection and hand sanitizer, and N95 masks are scarce. Hi, Jennifer. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, Jennifer, what do you think about this breaking news that we're just getting? I'm just reading from the New York Times that Peter Gaynor, the FEMA administrator, told CNN that the administration is going to insert language into this law for a mask contract for 500 million masks.
Yeah, I mean, that's very encouraging. The Defense Production Act, obviously, which was enacted in the 50s in response to the Korean War, would be amazing and useful thing to have enacted. 5 days ago, the president had also said it was going to be invoked to make ventilators, masks, goggles, sanitizer, cleaning supplies. And then as of yesterday, it was off the table. So I'm like very, I'm cautiously hopeful that the president and the administration will require these corporations to manufacture this personal protective equipment that we need and we just do not have right now. Unfortunately, I feel like the administration sort of taken the position that it has to be voluntary production at the discretion of those corporations. So hopefully we're really turning a corner on this.
Well, Jennifer, a lot of us are learning about this Wartime Production Act for the first time. Mm-hmm. A lot of people did not know that so many hospitals were so lacked the protective gear that you also desperately need. So mm-hmm. at this point, how would you like to see this roll out so this gear could get to your hospital as soon as possible?
Well, so right now, the situation is that we have, it's not an overstatement to say at the various hospitals around the Bay Area and around the country that you have people like wearing bandanas with surgical masks, you know, friends and neighbors are sewing masks for patients, for healthcare providers at the hospital, or making homemade hand sanitizer for workers on the jobs. We're treating people without being properly protected. So I hadn't seen the news you were talking about from the New York Times, but the idea that 60,000 test kits are coming out, I'm going to say that is great. It's probably a little short-sighted. It's probably not quite enough, we're a little behind in that production. Because I think in the production of what I would like to see, obviously, is we would have enough protective equipment for the workers to be able to wear them every day. And this is all of the staff that's in the hospital, because whether you're a security guard at the front desk or whether you're a clerk that's checking someone into the unit or whether you're a nurse or doctor in triage or on the floor, you obviously need to protect yourself. Because if you're not protecting yourself, you're just becoming a vector to other patients and visitors and your community and family members as well. So obviously I'd like to see the protective gear and the toolkit and the test kits all rolled out at the same time as proper screening tools in the hospital. I mean, we're just very behind the eight ball in how we've come up against this virus, not just at my facility. It's not fair to blame one organization, but at just in general in the United States and other countries everywhere.
Right. And Jennifer, we're reading in real time from the Wall Street Journal, Politico, and the New York Times. And based on their reporting, wow, it could take weeks or months for manufacturing facilities to reconfigure themselves to make new products. Mm-hmm. So,
well, and the things we're shooting for, they're talking about test kits and masks, which is great. But there was an article last week, I don't know if you saw it or not, that was published in the New Yorker that was provided by a colleague of mine to everybody at the facility, and it was written by Atul Gawande. And there's someone I'd call like a conscientious doctor ally, began working just yesterday to institute mandatory surgical masks and gloves for all the clinicians and nurses that have direct patient contact. So this is a really great idea, I would say, but one of the things in terms of the lack of supplies is that it doesn't really consider the rest of the recommendations from the article, which require separation and isolation of every person who presents to the facility with any single respiratory symptom. The other thing it doesn't consider is that you need to confront the problem of supply, is that we're, for our hospital specifically, we're a very large inpatient unit with a busy triage. We have a very significant homeless population, patients with multiple comorbidities, which makes them very high risk, and we do need the tools to protect them. But we're not the ED, and we're not the ICU, and our friends and colleagues in these units have far more people under investigation and positive COVID patients. And so we're being asked to wear gloves and masks full-time with any patient contacts, but then are we diminishing those reserves if, say, the production is 2 weeks out for the people really, who really need them? I mean, anesthesiologists are intubating positive patients without the proper protective equipment, and that's pretty unconscionable.
Jennifer, as a triage nurse at a large Bay Area hospital, can you just give us a sense of what a day is like now?
Well, it's difficult. I'm not in the ED, so I'm in an inpatient unit, so it's very precarious. We have the hospitals on, all the hospitals are on lockdown, so no visitors are allowed, only under very extreme circumstances. Typically, if it's a minor or if somebody is end of life decisions. So a typical day at the hospital is that you have a fast pass to come into the hospital as a healthcare worker, which we know from Italy, and actually a very good example is South Korea, is that healthcare workers should be being tested on a very much more regular basis, and healthcare workers typically aren't getting tested at all. But on a typical day, we come to work, we put on our protective gear, we can no longer meet and have a group meeting as you typically do at the beginning of the day, because we all need to remain 6 feet apart, so it's a little bit hard to have, you know, total situational awareness of what's going on. And then we just wait and hope that our screening at the front door is effective. Oftentimes it's not, either because people are, you know, a little reticent to speak about symptoms, people are nervous, people have felt, you know, there's been, like, some racism associated, as you know, with how the virus has been talked about, particularly by the administration. So all of these things that are keeping people from necessarily revealing their symptoms. So we get somebody that we're ruling out as a person under investigation, is what we call them. It's sort of like we're hoping to catch them at various stages so that we can immediately isolate that patient and then test and isolate for as long as we need to.
Is racism happening against staff or against patients or both?
Well, the idea that it is a... It's not so bad at this moment, but as it was in the beginning when it was being, particularly the administration calling it a Chinese illness,
right.
he definitely saw people that were, you know, nervous about revealing where they had traveled, or, you know, family members that may have traveled and been in different parts of the world, just because of that particular attitude that can be very damaging.
Right, and we're seeing stories about racism against Asian Americans as a result of this, and we're definitely going to do a segment on that in the coming weeks. Today we're joined by Jennifer Caraher, a public health and advanced practice triage nurse at a large Bay Area hospital. Jennifer is also a medical sociologist. She says her hospital has run out of eye protection and hand sanitizer, and N95 masks are scarce. And if you'd like to join us, if you are a frontline healthcare worker at any level of a hospital or a public health clinic, what are you seeing? You can all remain anonymous if you'd like. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Jennifer, how are you doing right now? You and I have been in contact over email. We first had a nurse on, gosh, just over 2 weeks ago, who said hospitals are woefully unprepared. And I believe you heard that segment because you sent us an email. So we've been emailing, and you've just sent us these pretty lengthy descriptions of what's happening at your hospital. So how are you and your colleagues doing right now?
I think everybody's doing pretty well. And I should say the lack of hand sanitizer was like a day-long situation in which we needed it from.
Okay.
It just wasn't available on the floor at that particular moment, but we actually have hand sanitizer. It is obviously something that we would worry about running out of at some point, but I think the production of that would be much easier than things like N95 masks. But I think the colleagues are doing fine. I mean, it's a very high level of stress for nurses, doctors, everyone. Things change on, you know, basically an hourly basis. So, like, really getting behind how we're reacting to the changes with whether it's the equipment that we have, how many tests we have, how we're testing staffing. I mean, obviously, nurses who are exposed are going to be out sick and they're going to self-quarantine. And then that puts us in the unfortunate position of being understaffed, which obviously is very difficult for patients and the other staff that has to, you know, take on the responsibility. I mean, I think one of the biggest problems right now is that our screening has just hasn't been great at any of the hospitals in the area or in the United States. It took us a pretty long time to realize that. I said to you in previous correspondence to stop being cavalier about the gravity of the public health crisis that's at hand. I mean, I think we're just, and in some cases, we're still failing to understand, like, the extreme risk of community transmission. And that's not just by people in the hospital. I mean, the shelter in place not being enforced in a way that would protect people better is upsetting to many of us in the medical community.
Well, so what would you like to see at this point, given that you all are watching this unfold from the front lines?
I'm sorry, what was the first part of the question?
What would you like to see? What changes would you like to see in terms of sheltering in place, physical distancing, that kind of thing?
Well, I think we'd all like to just see people staying at home and actually only going out for emergency reasons. I mean, if obviously people need to eat. Seems that people have done a pretty good job of stocking up if you've been to the grocery store recently. But I would just say that there are estimates, you know, of the number of people that are infected with the virus. And those estimates are based on people that haven't been tested yet. They're based on the number of people that have been tested and people that are testing positive. There are so many people that have not been tested. So in other words, you know, people going out in the community, whether it's to go to the market or it's to go for a bicycle ride, you know, the Embarcadero has been packed downtown on several days. But there are, like, several hundreds of thousands of people that are walking around carrying the virus. And we're only looking at the people who are sick. So this puts the providers really behind the eight ball because we don't know who we're treating. We don't know how to protect ourselves, how to protect the patient, how to protect our communities, because whoever we come in contact with, whether it's in the community, whether it's our neighbors, and whether it's somebody walking in the door, we can be seeing somebody for a totally different complaint, and for all we know, they could be a carrier of the virus, and we are just acting as vectors to infect other people in the community.
And how are you all dealing with this when you leave the hospital to go home, not knowing if you're positive or not?
Yeah, I mean, some people have such extreme measures as that they're, I heard of one doctor who's, has a separate living quarters in the garage so that he's living separate from his family because he has a child that has a some sort of autoimmune disorder. I know most of us, we all wear hospital-ordered scrubs that are left and laundered at the facility. So everything's there. We leave our shoes and everything there and then come home and immediately shower, take paper bags for our lunches, you know, that we discard, keep a distance from each other. But in terms of not having contact with family members in the house, that's pretty difficult. Mm.
We have an email from Jackie who says, many people answered the call to make homemade masks that could be used, washed, and sanitized and reused on top of the N95 masks that medical personnel are being forced to reuse. The directions for the homemade masks that I saw came from the Deaconess Hospital in Indiana. Could these still be a helpful alternative until new masks are manufactured and delivered?
I'm sorry, what was the last part of the question?
Can these still be a helpful alternative? I've seen some...
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, any mask that we can get, we're taking all of the hospitals, or taking any kinds of donations. The N95 masks that we wear in the hospital, we have to go through a fit testing protocol, which is like a 30-minute test to make sure that none of the aerosolized bacteria the virus is getting through the mask, which is different than, say, the N95 masks that people use when they're doing construction on their homes or something. But any masks at this point that we get, we are taking, because we're trying to wear surgical masks all the time. And at some point, all of those resources are going to diminish. Furthermore, having the N95 masks and being able to cover them with some other kind of mask, whether it's something that someone's sewn or whether it's a plastic mask, is great, because as of last week, we learned that while we were treating this as a droplet precaution, there was a correspondence and NIH study to be published that shows gives pretty solid evidence that the coronavirus is very similar to the SARS virus in that it is more of an airborne precaution. We should be practicing airborne precautions because it is an airborne illness.
And Jennifer, Jackie was specifically talking about homemade masks.
Yeah, that's great. The homemade masks, we can wear them over the top of the N95s, so that allows us to, as you know, we've been asked to reuse our N95 masks. It allows us to protect those and wear them for a longer period of time.
And KQED has a website, or a web page, I should say, with a lot of information about where to donate. Thank you for putting that together. And we have a link at yourcallradio.org. You can find that online at yourcallradio.org. I also wanted to ask you, Jennifer, about what we're hearing from the CDC. And the CDC recommends measures such as hand washing before adjusting the masks and storing them in clean paper bags when not in use. They say face masks are an acceptable alternative when the more protective N95 are not available. What are your thoughts about the CDC's guidelines?
Mm-hmm. The CDC guidelines about the mask protection is still based on, and I think you're getting that from the link on the healthcare providers at the CDC. And if you look at the date, I think the last time that was updated was on the 14th. I'm not sure when they're going to change their guidelines. I mean, obviously, not only is that based upon treating it as a droplet precaution, but it's also based on the fact of what kind of equipment that we have. I mean, we just don't have the equipment to be able to you know, for everyone to be able to have an N95. And we want our colleagues and our friends that have the most direct contact with the positive patients, the patients that are known positive, we want them to be able to have the protective equipment, because what's happening now is, you know, in many facilities, you know, starting a couple of weeks ago, they're given their N95s, they're given a paper bag with it, and you wear it, and when you exit the room, you put that mask in that paper bag. Clearly, that's not ideal. We now have extended wear guidelines that were provided by the CDC, which is just to continue to wear your N95 while caring for your patients. And now that patient assignment, typically I would hope would be a one-to-one assignment, but it doesn't mean that you aren't coming in contact with other people while you're still wearing that mask that you could potentially touch and touch another surface. So it's definitely not ideal.
And Jennifer, I'm wondering, when we get, it seems like the breaking news alerts come out, you know, every hour or so. And this morning, we learned from Governor Andrew Cuomo that in New York, the rate of infections is doubling every 3 days. He said, we have not flattened the curve. The curve is actually increasing. He said the state could need as many as 140,000 hospital beds, which is an increase from the 110,000 that officials projected earlier in the week. Can you give us any insights when you're talking with your colleagues at the hospital just about the changes that we're seeing so quickly? I mean, what's going through your mind? Because we're all wondering, how are we going to prepare for what's to come just based on what we're seeing in other countries and now what we're seeing in New York?
Well, I know at my hospital, and as in many other hospitals, that the upper management and the people that are really like on the task force for the infectious disease control are really trying to be on top of it, meeting daily, obviously they can't meet in person, so they have to have telephone meetings to really stay on top of everything coming out. But yeah, we're prepared at all the hospitals to open other units and use all of the isolation rooms that we have available. It's true, as I was saying, where they're just like probably several hundreds of thousands of people that are walking around with the virus that we don't know about yet. And clearly some of those people, and I mean, hopefully not, but obviously some of those people are going to become very ill, and we're going to need to figure out how to have the capacity to care for those people. Italy, our curve follows Italy's curve very closely, and we have just such a massive population. The other thing that's different about us, like while we don't have the elderly population that Italy has, the number of people in this country, particularly in urban areas such as here, we have so many people with comorbidities. We have so many problems with homelessness. We have the health disparity is like a huge issue in this country when we don't have a pandemic crisis on our hands. So we're trying to prepare ourselves in the best way possible, but it's very difficult to get behind this. Get in front of it, I should say.
Yeah, Jennifer, we're going to be talking about homelessness and what city and local officials are doing to try to get as many people inside as possible. Can you give us a sense of, since you work with the homeless population, what are you seeing?
Well, we see people being turned away from shelters because they don't necessarily meet the criteria being given like warm shelter for the night. For example, if you're somebody that has an underlying illness but you're a young person, you may be turned away from a shelter in favor of people over 65 that may need the bed in the shelter. So we have seen people come into the hospital, you know, by ambulance after having this experience because they've had, you know, an anxiety attack, and they are just like very scared for their health and for their well-being. I mean, I know Governor Newsom is trying to open many beds. There was funding for hotels in which to have basically like pop-up shelters for homeless people. So hopefully this is in the works.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for all the work that you do. Thank you for joining us. And I will definitely stay in touch with you on email to get regular updates. And we'd love to check in with you in the coming weeks.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you for giving voice to all the healthcare workers. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for all the work you do. Thank you.
Thanks.
That is Jennifer Karaher. She's a public health and advanced practice triage nurse at a large Bay Area hospital. She's also a medical sociologist. And we're talking about the ongoing demand by nurses and frontline workers for protective gear. And again, just some breaking news from the New York Times. The Trump administration is planning to use a wartime production act for the very first time today and mandate the production of 60,000 coronavirus test kits. As Jennifer said, you know, it's great that we're going to get that, but that number is far too low. They are also going to insert language from the law into a mask contract for 500 million masks. Based on the research that we've done since this broke, it looks like it still is going to take quite a bit of time to get those masks to where they need to be. So we will continue to be on this. I mean, where we are right now is corporations are donating masks. That's just where we are. And KQED has a list if you're in the Bay Area of where to donate masks and other medical supplies. So if you work for a company that has a stash and they can donate, please go to our website and pass this information on. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will talk about economic relief. April 1st is right around the corner. People are going to be needing to pay their bills soon. So where is the financial relief? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about when workers can expect relief. Bills are due very soon. We're talking about credit card bills, phone bills, electricity bills. People need relief right now. So why is this taking so long? Joining us to talk about the federal relief package and what is happening at the local and state levels are two guests. Stephen Greenhouse was a New York Times reporter for 31 years. He spent nearly two decades covering labor and the workplace. His latest book is Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Hi, Stephen. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be here, Rose. Sorry about being such a difficult time.
Oh, I know. Well, thank you for all the work that you're doing and just trying to get the word out to people. We're also joined by Adam Briones, Director of Economic Equity at the Greenlining Institute. They advance economic opportunity and empowerment for people of color. Hi, Adam. Thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Hi, good morning, Rose. Thank you for having me on.
Well, great to have you. Stephen, I want to start off with you. This is a very basic question. I was just looking at the calendar, and April 1st is right around the corner. It's next Wednesday. Now, my credit card bill is due, my phone bill, my electricity bill, my garbage bill, and this applies to people all across this country. Why is it taking so long for relief to arrive? I mean, at the federal level, they haven't even decided on what kind of relief that will be.
Well, apparently, depending, you know, Mitch McConnell says we're five yards from the goal line. Chuck Schumer says we're 2 yards from the goal line. Finally, they're making progress. I mean, it is a humongously complicated thing to try to figure out how to save this, you know, $20 trillion economy. And we'll probably have more people laid off this coming week than any week in American history, maybe 3 million people. And it probably wasn't helpful for Mitch McConnell and the Senate to take off 3 days last weekend. And, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans in the Senate haven't agreed on what the ideal package is. But there is a sense of urgency, Rose, and hopefully in the next 2-3 days, a package will be approved that will provide lots of unemployment insurance, you know, $1,200, you know, to every worker, $500 per kid. And I hear this talk of even provides some money to, you know, gig workers and independent contractors, you know, whose jobs are disappearing.
Right.
So it's, you know, it's a hugely complicated mess. There's a lot of pain out there. A lot of different industries need help. A lot of workers in many different industries and types of work need help. So it's, you know, it's hard to craft a one size fits all package that will help the nation's 150 million workers and God knows how many industries.
Stephen, what are you hearing about a timeline? Because we had McClatchy's economics reporter, Kevin Hall, on last week on Friday, and he said, let's say they come up with an agreement today, the likelihood of people getting their relief checks very soon, well, he said it might take 2 weeks. The other question is, how do you get it into people's bank accounts if banks are closing and if people don't use online banking? So there's a lot of questions about how the money will actually be distributed.
Kevin's very smart. I worked with him 40 years ago. That's a great question. I mean, usually it takes a week or two to get out unemployment insurance checks. And now they say these $1,200 checks, they're also going to try to get out within 2 weeks. You know, hopefully this can be done electronically. You know, it'll be hard for people to walk to the unemployment insurance now offices now. So that's how complicated it has to be done increasingly by computer and by phone. But, you know, the good news is there's a sense of urgency. The bad news is we have a federal government, a Trump administration, which, as many of us know, doesn't have its act together in 800 different ways. And one end doesn't know what the other end is doing. But, you know, I think a lot of folks in Congress really want something done. They see the urgency. A lot of governors, you know, in California, in Ohio, in Illinois, here in New York, you know, really are doing very well on this. I think they'll try their best to make sure the unemployment insurance gets out quickly to workers. And one of the good pieces evidently coming out of this new federal bill is that unemployment insurance, instead of being 50% of regular pay, will be 100% of regular pay for 4 months. So that's great. That, if I understand correctly, you know, will hold a lot of people whole, will enable them to pay their rent, will enable them to buy food. But it's still going to be a very difficult few months ahead.
Adam, at the Greenlining Institute, you have all put out a report talking about what needs to be in this relief package, especially for people on the margins, the most vulnerable workers. What are your thoughts about what you are calling for and what you are hearing from reports about what is in the bill?
Sure. I think from a high level, I think there are certainly things we like. We definitely are supportive of the direct cash payments as well as the set-asides for small business in the medical field. But I think that if you look back at history, and especially the last economic crisis, you know, it's really communities of color that suffer first, and they suffer the most. And so we really want to make sure that what's being proposed is of a size and scale that's actually going to put off some of the economic pain that we saw so clearly in the last economic crisis. And we also really feel like whatever is put out needs to focus on the people that make our economy and our society function. So it has to focus on the workers, on small business, on homeowners and renters, on students and nonprofits, and not just very large corporations.
Also, Adam, vulnerable workers are going to have a very hard time paying their bills, because we've seen so many studies over the years just showing that so many people do not have much savings. They couldn't come up with $400 to pay their bill. But we're also now talking about, you know, people in the, you know, it's hard to even say what the middle is anymore, but hairdressers, for example, construction workers, grocery store workers. I mean, a lot of people, although they are on the front lines, but a lot of people are also losing their jobs in that sector. So you've got people at many different levels of the workforce that are going to be hit hard and need relief as soon as possible.
Absolutely. And that's why we also think that whatever economic package is passed, this cash transfer to workers and families can't just be a one-time occurrence.
Right.
We really feel like it needs to last at minimum 6 months, but ideally somewhere closer to 12 months, because as you just mentioned, you know, families are going to really be hurting in this situation, and it's not going to end with a turn of a light switch. This is something that we'll likely be dealing with for a year to 18 months to probably 2 to 3 years at minimum.
Right. And I should say I meant restaurant workers, because grocery store workers, thank you if you're listening, they're all on the front lines right now. But every single restaurant in my neighborhood is shut down. The little deli, all of the stores. And you've got artists that are affected by this, dancers, musicians, lighting directors. I mean, people at all sectors of the economy. Stephen, so, you know, you've covered labor for the New York Times for two decades. What are your thoughts on this? Because this is affecting people at all levels.
Sure. Yeah, Adam's absolutely right. You know, low-income workers, workers of color will be hit hardest. And many of them, you know, if they are laid off for a week or two or three, will already face problems, you know, paying their rent. Fortunately, you know, there's been a lot of pressure on banks, a lot of pressures on realtors. You know, some governors are saying, please don't do any foreclosures over the next month or two or three. So hopefully no one is going to be evicted. And there's talk of, you know, the $1,200 is good. Adam's totally right. We got to do it more than just once, because, you know, these artists, these restaurant workers, these gig, you know, these Uber drivers who used to have 30 rides a day and maybe are down to 5 rides a day, you know, they're not able to make ends meet. And, you know, $1,200 payment is nice, but it's not enough to really support a family, you know, for, you know, for months at a time. And one good piece of news I read, if I understood correctly, is that, you know, some of the lower income families are not going to get a full $1,200. They were going to get only a fraction of that. But I believe the Democrats pushed to make sure that, you know, low income workers and their families would receive the full $1,200 plus $500 per child. And, you know, going forward, figuring out what to do for, you know, independent contractors, for artists, for you know, tip workers who generally make only, you know, a relatively low base wage and might not get much in the way of unemployment insurance. You know, we have to, like, step back and figure out ways to help these workers and independent contractors who are hardest hit. And I think one of the big problems we faced compared to Europe was that when the Republicans were drafting their package, they were focused so much on bailing out the corporations and not enough on, you know, saving workers and maintaining employment. And, you know, and I've written that, you know, in Europe, several countries, Denmark, the Netherlands, and even the conservative government of Britain have first and foremost focused on maintaining employment, getting companies not to lay off people. And they'd say to companies, you know, in the Netherlands, we'll pay 90% of your workers' wages if you don't pay them, if you don't lay them off. Even Boris Johnson's government in the UK, you know, has a plan that, you know, British companies don't, you know, we'll pay 80% of your workers' wages, don't lay them off. And that's great because it helps, you know, prevent the recession from falling and helps keep workers attached to their companies. If, you know, once this horrible crisis is over, it will make it easier for companies and workers to rebound when these workers are still attached to their companies. One of the big problems with our moving so slowly in the U.S., as you note, Rose, is that tons of workers are getting laid off. They're becoming unattached to their companies, and that will make it harder for them and their companies and production and productivity and the economy to rebound once the worst of this crisis is over.
It was incredible to read about what other countries are doing, Stephen. I mean, you tweeted this piece from the New York Times, COVID-19's economic pain is universal, but relief? Well, it depends on where you live. And as you said, an out-of-work waitress in Amsterdam can count on the government to cover 90% of her wages. Cafe owners in Brussels receive about $4,300 to make up for lost revenue. And then, as you said, in the UK, it looks like the proposal would allow any employer to apply for grants to cover 80% of worker wages up to £2,500 a month. That's about $2,900, backdated through March 1st. Stephen, could we ever see any policy like this in the United States?
I would imagine, yes. I mean, we have kind of crept towards that through the back door by saying we're going to, instead of having regular unemployment insurance at 50%, we're going to have it at 100%. And that's nice, but you only get that once you've been laid off, and you, it's kind of too late. You know, the horses have escaped from the barn, from the stable, because the workers have already been laid off. It would have been good if we announced this, you know, 2 or 3 weeks ago, and that would have perhaps deterred a lot of companies from laying off their workers. There's this, you know, very good line in the New York Times story saying, you know, the philosophy in Denmark is better to pay companies to keep people employed than to pay for the disruption caused by mass layoffs and unemployment. And here in the United States, we're kind of going at it as backwards. We've done very little to dissuade companies from laying off people, and we're going to try to really help the workers once they've been laid off. And in Denmark, in the Netherlands, in Britain, they're really trying very hard to keep the economy intact by, you know, discouraging companies from laying off their workers.
Adam, it is pretty striking when you look at the differences between the United States and how other countries are dealing with this.
Absolutely, it is.
What are your thoughts? I mean, what would it take for the United States to embrace some of these policies?
Well, I think to Stephen's point, we need to stop thinking about just what is the dollar value today of the stimulus, and we really need to think about what is the stimulus saving us from. So, for instance, in the 2008 financial crisis, I've read studies that said that the long-term impact has cost every family in America about $75,000 because of the crash. So we really need to be thinking about what over the next decade is going to be the cost to our families and our small businesses, that this crisis is going to cause, and how much do we need to put in now to head that off. So for instance, when we talk about supporting families, I think we need to be a lot closer to $2,000 per family plus $1,000 per child. I think we need to be talking about pausing all mortgage payments and supporting homeowners, and not just mortgage payments, but all payments that are impacting workers, so small business loans, car payments, student payments. I think we need to also talk about stopping evictions. We should really be talking about just forgiving student debt at this point. There's about $1.7 trillion in outstanding student debt, and I've read studies that say if that was forgiven, we'd be adding about $100 billion annually to the economy. And then lastly, I really want to make sure that we don't forget about small community-based nonprofits that are on the front lines, supporting the homeless, supporting seniors, supporting the sick and elderly in their homes, because right now no one is really talking about them, and I think we also need a targeted stimulus package for those small nonprofits as well.
No, this is such a great point. I mean, these are the nonprofits that are doing the frontline work out on the streets, trying to reach people, especially people, our unhoused neighbors. What are things like at the Greenlining Institute? What are your thoughts about how you all are going to fare over the next couple of months?
So I would say that thankfully Greenlining is an organization that's about 30 years old. We have a staff of about 40 folks. So we'll be okay. We're going to make it through okay. I think we're in for a few tough years, as all nonprofits are. But who I'm really concerned about are these small grassroots nonprofits, the neighborhood folks that are really the first places that new immigrants, low-income workers, folks that are reentering society from prison, those are the nonprofits that they go to first. Those are the real frontline folks. And even in the best of times, they're barely hanging on and operating on a shoestring. And so I think that the economic impact of what's going on, from canceled fundraisers, canceled events, it's going to have such a huge impact on them. And I really hope that at a federal and state level, we can make sure that we're mitigating the pain for those community-based nonprofits.
Yeah, we will definitely do a show about that. That is Adam Briones, Director of Economic Equity at the Greenlining Institute. They work to advance economic opportunity and empowerment for people of color. Stephen Greenhouse was a New York Times reporter for 31 years. He spent two decades covering labor. His latest book is Beaten Down, Worked Up: The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Stephen, we've been talking about what is happening here in California, where you can apply for financial relief if you're unemployed, if you're a small business. What are your thoughts about how state and local governments are tackling this?
I was joking with, people saying it would have been great if Donald Trump had named Andrew Cuomo to be the coronavirus czar. I'm not usually a big fan of Cuomo, but he's done an amazingly good job on handling the coronavirus. I think Mike DeWine, Republican of Ohio, has really done a good job. I think Gavin Newsom, there in California has been on top of things. And, they've been ahead of the curve, far ahead of President Trump, in trying to, get people to self-isolate and really, telling the truth and accepting what science is telling them and not lying, not distorting what's happening. I just want to one thing that really bothers me about what's happened is, yes, California has a paid sick days law. Yes, New York has a paid sick days law. But 42 states in the nation do not have paid sick days laws. And it's been crazy that we have this horrendous, scary pandemic and tens of millions of American workers do not have paid sick days at work. And this very much hurts the lowest paid workers of color the most. The bottom 10% by income, 50% of those workers do not receive paid sick days. So too often workers face the choice of, especially if you face this terrible scourge of coronavirus, do I stay home from work and miss 3 or 5 or 7 days of work and not be able to feed my family? Or do I go into work and maybe infect my coworkers or infect customers? And many part-time workers at Amazon and Walmart have complained in recent weeks that they don't get part-time, that they don't get paid sick days. Finally, after a lot of pressure and a lot of embarrassment, Amazon agreed to provide paid time off, paid sick leave to its part-time workers yesterday. But you know, one of the big themes of my book is that America unfortunately treats its workers far worse than other industrial nations, and we are just one of two wealthy nations in the world that don't provide paid sick days to their workers. And I think a lot of the elite doesn't care that low-paid workers don't get paid sick days. But when there's a horrible contagion like this, I think finally the elite worries, wow, if I go to Whole Foods, if I go to Trader Joe's and the cashier doesn't get paid sick days, maybe I'll catch something from them. So finally, the elite is realizing maybe, it's kind of screwed up that, millions of workers in the United States don't get paid sick days. So finally, Nancy Pelosi was pushing this law, this bill that would have created paid sick days for everyone. And then corporate America, despite it saying that we no longer are going to emphasize profit maximization, corporate America won a carve out so that companies with more than 500 employees still don't have to provide paid sick days, despite the horrors of the coronavirus and the huge, transmissibility that it has, that it's spreading like wildfire.
The other thing is, and we're going to do a show about this, what about all of the immigrant workers? I'm thinking of immigrants working in restaurants and cafes. We'll do a show about farm workers, but what about them, Adam, in terms of getting relief, especially people who are undocumented and working in restaurants and all other industries?
No, absolutely, Rose. And I think that right now while the big picture numbers, I think, have started to firm up, the devil's really in the details with the economic package that's going to be coming out. So to your point, I think that those workers that are in cafes, that are frankly, keeping our shelves stocked, that are making sure that we have food on our table, we're not exactly sure how this is going to work for them. And one thing that we would like to see at the Greenlining Institute is for the Federal Reserve to start buying more long-term municipal bonds so that cities have more money to support low-income workers and more cash to make sure that folks aren't being evicted and that folks have the resources they need.
Adam makes a good point. I was speaking to a professor friend at Rutgers in New Jersey yesterday, and she does a lot of work with undocumented workers. And she's very, very worried. It will be hard for them to get unemployment insurance. Maybe many of them rely on food banks, but, food banks will have a problem remaining in operation when you're trying to maintain social distance. So it's, unfortunately going to be very, very tough for them, made tougher, of course, by a president who's so, hugely hostile towards, towards undocumented workers. And I worry a lot for them. And I see that there is some fundraising efforts arising over the past week or two to somehow get money to domestic workers and get money to undocumented workers who are going to have, really the hardest time of anyone in the country right now.
Exactly. And I've received emails from some of the restaurants that I subscribe to, and they're launching GoFundMe campaigns. There's a restaurant in Oakland, and they said, we have 50 people work here. We're like a family, and everybody's out of work. And they're trying to raise $30,000, which isn't that much money for 50 people. But that's now what they're doing, is launching GoFundMe campaigns. We just got an email from a listener who forwarded a campaign from Unite Here. And this listener said, cash makes a bigger difference than tax relief for so many people. So at this point, Stephen, for people who are concerned about paying the bills next week, when do you think people can expect some kind of financial relief?
So, the folks in Congress, the folks in Washington, and we've all learned not to believe everything the folks in Washington tell us, they say hopefully in 2 or 3 weeks, which, if you have a hard time making ends meet week to week, is still going to be tough. And, I keep thinking, of some of the biblical verses, help strangers in a strange land, help the least among us. And unfortunately, as we were discussing, undocumented workers, the poorest, they're going to have a very hard time right now when Washington seems so focused on, bailing out corporations. So hopefully whatever comes out of the Senate and the House will, really have effective measures to try to speed aid to, low-income workers, to the very neediest.
And we don't have time to take Mark's question, but thank you for calling, Mark. Adam, we have about a minute left. Mark says, it seems like this is an opportunity to restructure the U.S. economy.
I think absolutely. And I think the first thing, kind of going back to Stephen's earlier point, is we should really get rid of some of these ridiculous notions around the moral hazard debate around paid sick days. I think first and foremost, we need to immediately correct what I think is an outlier in the Western world, where the United States just doesn't support sick workers. So we need to do that. I think we'll see immediate health benefits and we'll see immediate economic benefits from extending some of the most basic paid sick leave type programs that other wealthy nations already have. And I think that from Greenlining's perspective, what we want to do is reorient the economy to make sure that all people are benefiting from recovery. I think what we saw the last time around was that families who started with less recovered much more slowly. I think what we saw was communities of color, especially women of color, recovered from the financial crisis much more slowly. So what we want to make sure is that there's a just recovery from this crisis, because we will recover. And we want to make sure that the dollars that go out are really supporting the folks that need it and not corporations.
Adam Briones is Director of Economic Equity at the Greenlining Institute. They work to advance economic opportunities for people of color. Adam, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Stephen Greenhouse was a New York Times reporter for 31 years. He spent two decades covering labor. His latest book is Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Stephen, thank you for your work. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you
back. Thanks very much. Keep up the good work, Rose.
All right.
It's a difficult crisis, and you're helping shed light to move us all forward.
Likewise. Thank you so much for your work, Stephen. And if you have any show ideas, if you're a worker out there and you want us to get your story out, if you don't know how to pay, if you don't know how you're going to pay your bills and you want us to get your story out, we're also calling state and local officials to try to get them on the line to answer your pressing questions. Since April 1st is right around the corner, so anytime, please email us your call at kalw.org. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about how much it costs to actually get treated for COVID-19, especially for those of us who are underinsured and uninsured. How are officials going to deal with this? And then we are going to talk about what city and state officials are doing to protect people experiencing homelessness. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.